Good evening, everybody. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Psalms 30. That is my psalm, and I'm jumping ahead a couple of psalms as Chris and Eddie will both be tackling Psalms 27 and Psalms 29. This psalm, though, is something that, like most psalms, I feel like I say the same thing, is near and dear to me because they're all awesome. This psalm is great because the topic of this psalm, or at least the reasoning behind this psalm, is the ark coming into Jerusalem. And it states it right at the very front. It's David writing this psalm of praise as the ark is coming in to Jerusalem. And it wouldn't do this psalm justice just by reading it without understanding its context, without understanding its history. And if you've ever been a part of a class, you know I love talking about the temple. I love talking about the tabernacle. The Old Testament to me is it is a piece of history. It is something concrete. It is something that has happened hundreds if not thousands of years ago. And it represents this great conversation between man and God. Where God in all of his infinite wisdom and all of his infinite love comes to a sinful world and he speaks to us. And I'm always blown away by what he says, and by what he does, and by what he requires from his people. The first question I have for you today is, what role did the tabernacle play in Jewish society? What role did the tabernacle play in Jewish society? And if you do not know what the tabernacle is, I encourage you to read the entirety of the Old Testament, because it is prominent throughout. And hopefully that isn't a word that is not... The tabernacle is everything. It is everything. Many of us are familiar with the story of Moses on Mount Sinai, that when God purchases for himself a slave nation from Egypt, the first place they go is Mount Sinai. And we are familiar with this story because Moses spends 40 days and 40 nights, and that number keeps popping up in here. It's significant. And he is up there talking with God for a month. A month he is up there talking to God. And that's usually where we stop. We'll talk about what happens when he comes back with the Ten Commandments and he sees Israel sinning and he throws the tablets down and judgment is passed on to Israel. We know the story of Moses going before God saying, I want to see you face to face. But what's happening here is Israel stays at the foot of Mount Sinai for almost 2 years. 2 years digesting, consuming the law that God has given through Moses to his people. And the one thing that they come away from this is not just the Ten Commandments. That is small peas compared to the tabernacle that God gives to Israel. And I wish I can go through every detail of the tabernacle. And I really encourage you, I challenge you to Wikipedia, study what that tabernacle looked like, because every inch of that facility had meaning. Every inch, every layer of carpet, of rug that was draped over the golden walls of the tabernacle had meaning, had significance. And there were seven. The walls that surrounded the tabernacle, the inner courtyard, the altar, the baptistry, which is amazing. This huge bronze tub where the priest was baptized before he went into the Holy of Holies. Everything had significance. See, when Israel, while they were journeying in the wilderness, the way they moved about the wilderness was that God would enter into the tabernacle, enter into the tent of meeting, and he would signify that it is time to move. And what would happen is there was a certain set of people. They were not just Levites, they were a subculture of the Levites, a sub-society in the Levitical priesthood. And they would take the tabernacle and they would break everything down. And they would take and they would package it, and they would move. And so a horn was blasted throughout Israel when the ark was ready to move. And everybody, regardless of where you were, had to turn away from the center of the camp, because that's where the tabernacle was. The tabernacle was in the center of Israel. It represented the presence of God amongst his people. It represented that God was working through this nation, that not only did he purchase these slaves, but they were his. He owned them. And so when that horn was heard, you turned your back because you were not allowed to look at the ark. And so the ark was carried and the ark left. And they had to wait for around 2 days before they themselves can pack up and follow after the ark. And when they knew when to stop, that was when the ark was placed, when the tabernacle was built around the ark. God would come to the ark and say, this is where I want us to camp for the day, for the month, for the year. And that tabernacle would be built around the Ark of the Covenant. And then as Israel would approach the tabernacle, they would form up around the tabernacle. I mention all of this, and it may be boring, but to me it is interesting because the tabernacle stood for their culture, their society, their government, everything. You've heard me use this word before, that God, in the very beginning of Israel's history, built a theocracy. And what that means is there was no king. There was no government. There were no senators. There were no Congress. There was nothing. And that is incredible, because to think of this, that God expected his nation to rule themselves. Rule themselves without tax collectors, without governors, without any system of government higher than the high priest. Nothing. And he built this system so that they would look at the tabernacle and they would see that God is supplying everything for them. He says, I'm not going to give you tax collectors. Instead, anytime that you go to the temple, I'm going to ask you to tithe. And on top of that, anytime that you see someone in need, I expect you to give freely. It was a beautiful, beautiful system. The tabernacle to the Jewish culture meant everything. It was their church. It was their government. It was their social justice programs. It was absolutely everything. So that by the time we get to David, something has happened. Something has changed. They're no longer wandering through the wilderness. They have been established in the nation that we commonly see, that we know as Israel. However, the tabernacle is still traveling throughout Israel. All right, there is no temple yet. Meaning that in the wilderness, the tabernacle was there to tell Israel where they're to go, where they're to camp, how long they're supposed to stay there, and the exact details of their daily life was determined by the tabernacle. And so when they went into Israel and they inhabited the land, this was incredible. The tabernacle would travel throughout Israel. Now, I want you to imagine, how well would you do church if church moved around the city of Ventura? Would you be willing to travel weekly to a new location? Many of us would love that. I mean, I would love that. That'd be a new location. We could have it on the beach several times a month. Right? Wouldn't that be great? Now, this is how the tabernacle was built. The tabernacle moved. The temple moved around. Sometimes it would be in northern Israel. Sometimes it would be in the desert of Negev, down in the southern part of Israel. And so imagine a nation where your temple, your church, moved around from place to place to place. And again, I need to put you in the shoes of a normal Jew during this time. That your city, you have not seen the temple in months, weeks, years, and then all of a sudden you hear the temple is coming. The tabernacle is coming. The tabernacle is coming close to you. It could be a mile, it could be 5 miles, 10 miles, regardless. It's within a day's walk of where you're at. How excited would you be to see the tabernacle coming towards your city, coming towards your area? This is what I loved, again, about this system, because it would show these people God coming to them. And this was, again, this is obviously a symbol of God's presence, because God was in the midst of them regardless of where the temple was. But this is a very powerful cultural symbol, that they would sit at home and they would see the horn sound, or they would hear the horn sound, and they would know that the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy of Holies, the presence of God was coming to them. That they would soon be able to go to the tabernacle and offer sacrifices. Soon they would be able to go and give something to God. Pretty soon they would be able to go and they would see the smoke of the altar billowing into the air as their sacrifice was being offered to God. And they would know that God was being worshipped by them. And that is what the altar represented. When they went to the tabernacle and they offered their sacrifice, that was worship. That was them bringing what they had before God and offering it to them on the altar. Much like Romans chapter 12, where he says, this is our job, is to offer our bodies. It is our job to sacrifice ourselves under this altar. And so David sees this happening. He sees the tabernacle moving around Israel, and he wants to change something. See, by 2 Samuel chapter 6, David has been a king not too long, but he wants to do something more. He wants to change this system. He wants to bring the tabernacle to Jerusalem, and that's where he wants to keep it. So first, I want you to listen to this as we go to 1 Chronicles chapter 28, and I want you to hear David's heart here. David summoned all the officials of Israel to assemble at Jerusalem, the officers over the tribes, the commanders of the divisions in the service of the king, the commanders of the thousands and commanders of the hundreds, and the officials in charge of all the property and livestock belonging to the king and his sons. Together with the palace officials, the warriors, and all the brave fighting men, King David rose to his feet and said, "Listen to me, my fellow Israelites, my people. I had it in my heart to build a house as a place of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, for the footstool of our God. And I made plans to build it. But God said to me, 'You are not to build a house for my name, because you are a warrior and have shed blood.'" And I want you to imagine how disappointing that must be for David. David, and hopefully you guys know the story of David. I'm going to assume that many of us are familiar with that story. David started out as a shepherd. King David, as he is making this proclamation, as he is addressing an army, his people, you have to assume that in his head, everything he has is because of what God has done for him. That his kingship, his authority, the fact that people love him, all of this has flowed from the graces of God. And so as you, someone who is now a king, who grew up as nothing, goes before God and says, "God, I want to thank you in some way. God, I want to praise you, bless you. I want to do something amazing. I want you to be near me forever, for as long as I live. I want your house to be next to my house." And God's response is, "Your hands are covered in blood. Your hands are covered in, you're a warrior. Your hands are covered in the blood. No. You can't build my temple, David. You cannot build this. I'm going to reserve this for your son. He will build this." And so God at least allows David to collect the materials needed for this temple. But imagine the disappointment. The disappointment he must have felt. That this opportunity to praise, to worship, to say thank you to God was turned off for him. But it keeps going. Verse 4. "Yet the Lord, the God of Israel, chose me for my whole family to be king over Israel. He chose Judah as leader, and from the tribe of Judah, he chose my family. And from my father's sons, he was pleased to make me a king over all Israel. All of my sons, and the Lord has given me many. He has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord, the Lord over Israel. He said to me, 'Solomon, your son is the one who will build my house and my courts. For I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. I will establish his kingdom forever if he is unswerving in carrying out my commands and laws, as is being done at this time. So now I charge you in the sight of all of Israel and in the assembly of the Lord and in the hearing of our God, be careful to follow all the commands of the Lord your God, that you may possess this good land and pass it on as an inheritance to your descendants forever.'" I want to pick several of these things out before we actually go to Psalms 30. Here's some interesting points that I see. The tabernacle was handed down from God, and it was perfect. The tabernacle was given to Moses. So imagine, you go before God and say, "God, how do you want to be praised? How do you want to be worshipped? God, tell me, and I will do it. I will follow every detail." And he gives you the tabernacle. He gives you this temple, this moving presence of God that represented his presence within his nation. And so David comes along and says, "God, I want to change that. I want to change it a bit. Instead of it moving around, I want to put it in one place. Instead of one court at a specific measurement, I want multiple courts. I want courts that represent not only the priests, but I want a court of the men. I want a court of the women. I want a court of the Gentiles. I want to build something great and grand, something beyond the tabernacle." And God allows it. This is incredible. God allows changes to his perfect plan. See, we see God opening himself up to the influences of imperfect people, and he accepts it. We see God saying, giving men the opportunity to change things, and God allows it. God takes these changes and goes forward and says, I want you to remember something. Yes, I'm going to let you do this. Or specifically, I'm going to let your son do this. But you must know who is in control. You must know who is behind all of this. See, the problem I see, and before we go to Psalms 30, is David has the same issue sometimes we do. We think that because we can influence through our prayer and through our actions, we can influence the plans of God, that therefore we can take it beyond and we can say to ourselves, we are in control. We are the ones who are doing this. And as God is responding to David, he goes, I want you to make sure that this temple is a symbol of my presence before you, that there is a kingdom, there is a people, there is a law that's going to go beyond you. It's going to go beyond you, David. It's going to go beyond your house, that your household is representative of a bigger promise, of a bigger plan. And though God allows David to build this temple, though God allows David to bring in the Ark of Jerusalem where it will stay, he reminds him of the eternal solution. David is not the eternal solution. David is not the goal. This is not, David isn't the promise that God had in mind in Genesis chapter 3. That he looks beyond this. And we see more of this in the next chapter. We see this promise in 2 Samuel chapter 7, where again, God talks to David and says, remember, you are not the end game here. You are one step on a long path to eternity, onto a descendant of yours that will be eternal. But I want you to notice this, that God allows David to change an aspect of his perfect plan. And God tells him to go forward with this. It is just amazing to me. So finally, and we are familiar with this story, that God gives in, and he allows David to bring the cart into Jerusalem. And in 2 Samuel chapter 6 is where the story is found, and I'm going to kind of summarize this. David is just excited, and he allows his excitement to make some horrible decisions because David is just amazed that God is allowing him to do this. And he calls for the ark to come out, to come to Jerusalem. And so what they do is they build a new cart, and they put the ark onto the cart, and they carry it towards Jerusalem. But that is a bad decision. You were not supposed to put the Ark of the Covenant on any cart. It was made to be carried. Which is, again, an incredible symbol to the Jewish culture. That the Ark of the Covenant was not meant to just be carried around on a cart. You had to carry it. Someone had to carry it. And there was a specific subset of the Levite culture, a family, that's entire purpose was to carry this Ark around. But they didn't do that. They put it on a cart, and they were carrying it to Jerusalem, and the cart stumbled, and the Ark almost fell off the cart. And so someone put their hand up to stop it from falling, and he was immediately struck down. He was immediately killed because he was defying the laws of God. Where God says, I don't want anyone to touch it. You were not supposed to put it on a cart. You were supposed to carry it. Hence, it wouldn't fall anywhere. And so David stops right there. And he realizes, and he recognizes that something is off. All right? This should be a joyous occasion. There shouldn't be death involved in moving the ark to Jerusalem. This should be a glorious event. And so David stops for several months as he tries to decide why this all happened. And he realized that he wasn't supposed to be putting it on a cart. He was supposed to carry it. And so finally he resolves the situation and he picks people to carry the ark into Jerusalem. And he has a party. And what I'm blown away by this story, again, it found in 2 Samuel chapter 6, is that David acts in such a way as where people look at him and ridicule him because they think he's being inappropriate. As he is worshiping God and he's dancing half naked in the streets, his own wife tells him, what are you doing, David? But he is too excited. He's too overjoyed with the fact that the ark is now in his city, that the ark is now in Jerusalem, and he will start the construction. He will start collecting the materials needed to build a temple. So I want you to think, All right, you've lived your life with the church, with your concept of church, with your concept of community, the concept of the presence of God moving around. And so now finally, the ark of the Lord is in your hometown. That the presence of God is next door to your home. That this symbol of God's work, this symbol of history from the beginning of time until now, of God loving mankind, of God forgiving man's sins, this symbol is now your neighbor. That you look outside the window and you see the presence of God next to you. What would you say? What psalm would you write? What praise would come out of your lips? See, we are so accustomed to church being so easy. We are so accustomed to church being so free that we can freely worship wherever we want, whenever we want. We can say whatever we want. That we can do this freely. To go before God and to say, you are now my neighbor. You are now next to me. Now I can talk to you freely. Whereas before you were far away from me. You were in another city. You were in another country, another tribe. To now have God sit beside you. And this is what David says in Psalms 30. I will exalt you, Lord, for you lifted me out of the depths and did not let my enemies gloat over me. Lord, my God, I called you for help and you healed me. You, Lord, brought me up from the realm of the dead. You spared me from going down to the pit. Sing the praises of the Lord, you his faithful people. Praise his holy name, for his anger lasts only a moment, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping, you may stay for the night, but rejoice comes in the morning. When I felt secure, I said, I will never be shaken. Lord, when you favored me, you made my royal mountain stand firm. But when you hid your face, I was dismayed. To you, Lord, I called. To the Lord, I cried for mercy. What is gained if I am silenced? For if I go down to the pit, will the dust praise you? Will it proclaim your faithfulness? Hear, Lord, and be merciful to me. Lord, be my help. You turned my wailing into dancing. You removed my sackcloth and clothed me with joy. That my heart may sing your praises and not be silent. Lord, my God, I will praise you forever. That is the context of this psalm. David sees the ark. He sees the presence of God, and it is next to him. He recognizes all that God represented, all that God has given to David, everything. And his proclamation is, God, you have been good. You see, we see this so often in David's Psalms, as he talks about the laws of God, as he talks about the house of God, that this is something amazing to him. This is not something that he took for granted. This is something that when he saw, when he looked, it represented the whole spectrum of God's grace, both in the good and in the bad. And he praised God. So I challenge you. I challenge you that when you come here on Sundays, Wednesdays, Mondays, whenever your small group, whenever your ministry is here, that you come praising God. That his presence is in us. That when we come together, we should see that presence more clearly. That when we see each other, when we hang out with each other, when we worship together, we see the presence more clearly. That it is stronger when we are all together. I want to build on what Bruce was praying for. That it's not enough for just us to gather together. That would turn us into a social club. It is enough for us to gather together so that we see God in each other, that we see his presence in each other. That when I look at Bruce, I see what God is doing in his life. And hopefully that when Bruce looks at me, he is encouraged by what God is doing in my life. So that when we come together, that what comes out of our lips, what spills forth out of our hearts, is praise and worship. If you have any needs this night, please come forward as we stand and as we worship our God. I was sinking deep in sin, far from the peaceful shore.